Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record program number 459, titled Flying the Friendly Skies. This is being recorded on May 10th of the year 2004. And also the landmark text, Martin Bormann, a Nazi in Exile, is available on the Spitfire website for download for free. Okay, so do be aware of that. Also, now the Spitfire website is equipped with a search function, so you can search for particular items. For the Record, 459 is titled Flying the Friendly Skies, and what we're going to be looking at are some of the aspects of the air traffic in and around September 11th. There are a number of curious aspects to the September 11th air traffic situation. I think some of the wacko elements of the conspiracy theory community, and there's no shortage of those, have made too much of certain aspects of this. Bear in mind that the shooting down of a civilian airliner full of citizens over an urban area is not something that a military pilot is empowered to do on his or her own. An educated guess at some of the irregularities that were taking place vis-a-vis the planes and why they were not interdicted early. A lot of them were intercepted, according to report, but they were not shot down. Bear in mind that shooting down an airliner full of civilians over an urban area is just not something they can do. A lot of the more flaky elements of the conspiracy crowd have made far too much of some of this than they should have. I suspect that the plane over Pennsylvania may very well have been shot down. There are a number of indications in the media that that may have been the case. However, that is the least important of the four planes that was involved in the September 11th attacks. We're going to begin by taking a look at the fact that NORAD had actually been engaged in a drill that was similar to September 11th. This is important because Condoleezza Rice claimed that they had no forewarning of the fact of the type of attack that actually took place on September 11th, as we looked at in For the Record 456. In fact, the use of aircraft as kamikazes had been foreseen for many, many years, and there were a number of reports that terrorist attacks might take that form. Again, For the Record 456, that is available. No, actually, it's For the Record 454, excuse me. That's available in the description for the Record 454, or you can listen to it on the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website. Well, Condoleezza Rice's assertion that there was no forewarning of an attack like the attack that took place on September 11th is, quite frankly, BS. The following article is from USA Today's issue of 4/19/04, April 19th of 2004. This is an article by Stephen Comerow and Tom Squitieri. It's headline, NORAD had drills eerily like September 11th. Subtitled, Pentagon and Trade Center among imagined targets at state-lined Washington. It reads in part as follows. In the 2 years before the September 11th attacks, the North American Aerospace Defense Command conducted exercises simulating what the White House says was unimaginable at the time, hijacked airliners used as weapons to crash into targets and cause mass casualties. One of the imagined targets was the World Trade Center. In another exercise, jets performed a mock shoot-down over the Atlantic Ocean of a jet supposedly laden with chemical poisons headed toward a target in the United States. In a third scenario, the target was the Pentagon, but that drill was not run after defense officials said it was unrealistic, NORAD and defense officials say. NORAD, in a written statement, confirmed that such hijacking exercises occurred. It said the scenarios outlined were regional drills, not regularly scheduled continent-wide exercises. Numerous types of civilian and military aircraft were used as mocked hijacked aircraft, unquote, the statement said, again quoting, these exercises tested track detection and identification, scramble and interception, hijack procedures, internal and external agency coordination, and operational security and communication security procedures, unquote. A White House spokesman said Sunday that the Bush administration was not aware of the NORAD exercises. But the exercises using real aircraft show that at least one part of the government thought of the possibility of such attacks, though unlikely. But the exercises using real aircraft show that at least one part of the government thought the possibility of such attacks, though unlikely, merited scrutiny. On April 8th, the commission investigating the September 11th attacks heard testimony from National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice that the White House didn't anticipate hijacked planes being used as weapons. And that obviously is, shall we say, less than candid. Following story is a New York Times story. This was reprinted in the Salt Lake Tribune. This is a New York Times story by Philip Sheenan. It's headlined by the Salt Lake Tribune. 9/11 panel likely to say Pentagon attack was preventable. This is Dateline Washington, and also deals with NORAD, and specifically this questions why it took so long to intercept American Airlines Flight 77. The commission investigating the September 11th attacks is expected to offer sharp criticism of the Pentagon's Domestic Air Defense Command in the panel's final report, and will suggest that quicker military action on that morning might have prevented a hijacked passenger jet from crashing into the Pentagon, according to commission officials. The performance of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, and its failure to protect Washington and New York City from attack on September 11th will be a focus of the remaining public hearings of the 10-member commission, which is in the final weeks of its investigation. Commission officials said interim reports that were expected to be released at the hearings would suggest that NORAD had time on September 11th to launch jet fighters that could have intercepted and possibly shot down American Airlines Flight 77, which crashed into the Pentagon at 9:37 a.m., more than 50 minutes after the first hijacked plane struck the World Trade Center. A total of 184 people died in the Pentagon attack, including 59 aboard the hijacked plane. The commission is trying to establish a detailed timeline of how and when military pilots reporting to NORAD were informed on September 11th that President Bush had given the extraordinary order allowing them to shoot down passenger planes. NORAD officers have said previously that they didn't learn of the order until about 10:10 a.m., a few minutes after the last of the four hijacked jets crashed into a field in rural Pennsylvania. But White House officials have suggested that the order was made earlier in the morning and should have been communicated immediately to pilots. Well, again, reiterating one of the points I made earlier, it is not standard operating procedure to shoot down a civilian airliner full of passengers on a hijacking, and also doing so over an urban area would have probably resulted in even more loss of life. The plane would have pancaked down through a residential area or a commercial area, plus the ordnance that was used to shoot it down might very well have produced casualties as well. Nonetheless, there are some questions about why it took so long to get the plane into get interceptor aircraft into the air to intercept the plane that crashed into the Pentagon. Also, one should bear in mind that the commander-in-chief of the military is George Walker Bush, old AWOL George, and he was basically sitting there with that dumb look on his face in Florida. It would be interesting to know what Karl Rove and Dick Cheney were doing specifically on that day. The record of both men's actions is somewhat ambiguous. Cheney is in charge of terrorist planning for the U.S. government. Another interesting question concerning the government's performance vis-a-vis the Bush administration's performance vis-a-vis the airline industry on September 11th. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle on Tuesday, April 20th of the year 2004. This is an article by David Armstrong of the Chronicle. Its headline, 9/11 Testimony Shows Flaws in Alerting Airlines. Although Bush administration officials say they did everything possible to warn airlines about the threat of hijacking prior to September 11, 2001, a persistent pattern of testimony before the September 11th commission suggests the White House could have done more. The Federal Aviation Administration issued 15 information circulars regarding the threat of terrorist attacks on commercial airliners before the attacks that felled the World Trade Center had damaged the Pentagon, according to summaries of the circulars provided to the Chronicle by the FAA. But those information circulars were just general backgrounders, not security directives, which are higher alerts that direct airlines to take specific measures to protect themselves, Air Transport Association of America President James May has told the commission. The association is the airline industry's leading trade organization and lobbying arm in Washington, D.C. So again, more information somewhat at variance with what the Bush administration has had to say about their claims of activity vis-a-vis September 11th. Another New York Times article, and this concerns the destruction of a tape that was made of the air controller's statements on September 11th. This is from the New York Times of Thursday, May 6th of 2004. It's by Matthew L. Wald of the New York Times. It's headlined, FAA official scrapped tape of 9/11 controller's statements. It reads in part, at least six air traffic controllers who dealt with two of the hijacked men on September 11, 2001, made a tape recording that day describing the events, but the tape was destroyed by a supervisor without anyone making a transcript or even listening to it, the Transportation Department said today. The taping began before noon on September 11th at the New York Air Route Traffic Control Center in Ronkonkoma on Long Island, but it was later destroyed by an FAA quality assurance manager who crushed the cassette in his hand, cut the tape into little pieces, and dropped them in different trash cans around the building, according to a report made public today by the Inspector General of the Transportation Department. The Inspector General, Kenneth M. Meade, had been asked by Senator John McCain, chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, to look into how well the Federal Aviation Administration had cooperated with the 9/11 Commission. The quality assurance manager told investigators that he had destroyed the tape because he thought making it was contrary to FAA policy, which calls for written statements, and because he felt that the controllers, quote, were not in the correct frame of mind to have properly consented to the taping, unquote, because of the stress of the day, Mr. Meade reported. Another official, the center's manager, asked the controllers to make the tape because, quote, he wanted a contemporaneous recordation of controller accounts to be immediately made available for law enforcement, unquote, according to the Meade report, and was concerned that the controllers would take a leave of absence immediately, which is standard procedure after a crash. On the tape, the controllers, some of whom had spoken by radio to people on the planes and some who had tracked the aircraft on radar, gave statements of 5 to 10 minutes each, according to the Meade report. The center manager had agreed with the president of the local union chapter that the tapes would be destroyed once the standard written statements were obtained, Mr. Meade reported. Neither the center manager nor the quality assurance manager disclosed the tapes' existence to their superiors at the FAA region that covers New York or to the agency's Washington headquarters, according to the report. None of the officials or controllers were identified in the inspector general's report. Other tapes were preserved, including conversations on the radio frequencies used by the planes that day and the radar tapes. In addition, the controllers later made written statements to the FAA per standard procedure, and in this case to the FBI as well. But when one of the controllers asked if she could review her portion of the audio tape to refresh her memory before giving her witness statement, she was told she could not, according to Mr. Meade's report. The quality assurance manager destroyed the tape despite an email message sent by the FAA instructing officials to safeguard all records and adding, quote, if a question arises whether or not you should retain data, retain it, unquote. The inspector general ascribed the destruction to, quote, poor judgment, unquote. Quote, the destruction of evidence in the government's possession, in this case an audio tape, particularly during times of a national crisis, has the effect of fostering an appearance that information is being withheld from the public, the Meade report said. We do not ascribe motivations to the managers in this case of attempting to cover up, and we have no indication that there was anything on the tape that would lead anyone to conclude that they had something to hide or that the controllers did not carry out their duties, unquote. But keeping the tape's existence a secret and then destroying it did not, quote, serve the interests of the FAA, or the Republic, the report said. The inspector general also noted that the official who destroyed the tape had no regrets or second thoughts. The quality assurance manager told us that if presented with similar circumstances, he would again take the same course of action, unquote. Well, again, that's interesting. I would not say that was conclusive, and I wouldn't necessarily read too much into that, but it is unfortunate that they did not preserve that tape. It might be interesting to find out what was on it. I do think that with regard to September 11th, there are a great many things having nothing to do whatsoever with the behavior of the aircraft that are far, far more significant. The most damning of all has nothing to do with something, with things directly that took place on that day. It affects the circumstances. But in March of 2002, federal agents raided the Islamic charities and businesses that had apparently served as funding conduits for not only Al-Qaeda but Hamas. And on April 4th of 2002, Talat Altman, a close business and political associate of both Georges Bush, a director of Harkin Energy, one of George W.'s failed oil companies, a person who was part of the BCCI milieu and apparently got his position on Harkin Energy as a result of the pulling of some of the BCCI-connected strings, interceded with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill on behalf of the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids, and basically said, listen, hands off. Paul O'Neill was dismissed some months later. And again, the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids are also, in addition to the fact that Talat Altman interceded on their behalf, they are heavily overlapped with the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, and specifically the main area of overlap is the Islamic Institute, founded by Grover Norquist with the assistance of Karl Rove and also the aforementioned Talat Altman. And the Islamic Institute represents a direct intersection between the elements that were accused of helping to fund Al-Qaeda as well as Hamas and the Republican Party. And if one dollies back and gains a wider perspective, the Islamo-Fascist Muslim Brotherhood and the Al-Taqwa organization as well. In numerous broadcasts, we've looked at the intersection between the GOP, the Islamic Institute, and Al-Taqwa. There is a lot of information on the web, and there are numerous references to that. Some of the numbers off the top of my head, for the record, 356, 357, and FTR 415, as well as FTR programs 454, 455, and 456. And that'll give you a running jump on the areas of intersection between the GOP, the Bush administration, the funding of Al-Qaeda and Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood, and beyond that, the underground Reich, and the person of people like Ahmed Huber and Youssef Nada, the head of Bank Al-Taqwa and a former Third Reich intelligence agent, now a defendant in the trillion-dollar lawsuit by survivors of the families of September 11th. And again, the Internet has many of those references available for people who would like to peruse them. One of the most damning aspects of the issue of air travel on September 11th concerns the fact that John Ashcroft, of course, the Attorney General, stopped flying commercial jets only weeks before September 11th. It should be noted that at this point, there were abundant warnings of the fact that there were hijackings that were believed to be in the offing. This is from the Village Voice, specifically from the Mondo Washington column by James Ridgway. This is from April 13th and the April 13th edition of Mondo Washington. This column is titled Fear of Flying. Subtitled, Why Did Ashcroft Stop Flying Commercial Only Weeks Before September 11th? It's datelined Washington, D.C., and it reads in part, like most of the Bush cabinet, Attorney General John Ashcroft took commercial jets when he traveled. But on July 24th, 2001, he changed that practice and began flying in chartered government jets. Asked by CBS News at the time about the change, the Justice Department cited a, quote, threat assessment, unquote, by the FBI, and said Ashcroft had been advised to travel only by private jet for the remainder of his term. Quote, there was a threat assessment, and there are guidelines. He is acting under the guidelines, unquote, an FBI spokesman said. But as CBS went on to report, again quoting, neither the FBI nor the Justice Department, however, would identify what the threat was, when it was detected, or who made it, unquote. A, quote, senior official, unquote, at the CIA said he wasn't aware of specific threats against any cabinet member, and Ashcroft himself declared, quote, I don't do threat assessments myself, and I rely on those whose responsibility it is in the law enforcement community, particularly the FBI. And I try to stay within the guidelines that they've suggested I should stay within for those purposes, unquote. When asked if he knew details of the threat or who might have made it, Ashcroft said, "Frankly, I don't. That's the answer," unquote. The Justice Department did say that it wasn't Ashcroft who wanted to fly in leased airplanes, but that it was the idea of his FBI security detail. The FBI had no comment. All other Bush cabinet members flew on commercial airliners, save for the Secretaries of Energy and the Interior when they traveled to remote areas. Janet Reno, Clinton's Attorney General, traveled by commercial jets. So again, this is something about which I have more questions than answers, but it is interesting that John Ashcroft began flying leased aircraft and not commercial flights in late July, weeks before September 11th, and there were numerous threats out about the possibility of this type of attack at this point, the disclaimers of the Bush administration notwithstanding, to the contrary. Next, we're going to take a look at what is one of the most interesting aspects of air travel in and around September 11th. This is something we've spoken about on numerous broadcasts, including, for the record, programs 423, 425, and 454. And this concerns the fact that a number of members of the Saudi elite, not only members of the Saudi royal family, but also members of the very powerfully connected bin Laden family, who are business partners with the Bush family in a number of ventures, current and past, and they were able to fly out of the United States when no other civilians were able to fly. Among the bin Laden family members that were able to fly when no other civilians could were Abdullah and Khalil bin Laden, who both are implicated in the financing of al-Qaeda or in al-Qaeda-related activities. And interestingly enough, Abdullah bin Laden, one of the bin Ladens allowed to fly out of the United States, was associated with the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, which has been implicated in the investigations by a number of different countries in the financing of terrorism. One of his associates, one of Abdullah bin Laden's associates in the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, was a guy named Jamal Barzinji, who is not only associated with Bank al-Taqwa and Youssef Nada, but who also was connected to the Islamic Institute of Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, and Talat Otman. And again, as I said earlier, the Islamic Institute represents the point of intersection between the funding conduits that allegedly funded al-Qaeda and Hamas, the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, the Bush administration, and in the background, the Islamo-fascist Muslim Brotherhood and elements of the underground Reich. We're going to turn now to an excerpt of one of the postings on the website of Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor, and more about the identities of some of the people who were able to fly out of the United States in the wake of September 11th. Peter has titled this section, "More on the Saudi Private Jet Flights Right After 9/11." This was posted on April 7th of 2004. Right after September 11th, four private Saudi jets were given special dispensation to fly out of the U.S. beginning on September 15, 2001. The flight manifest showing passenger lists are now viewable online, and he gives the address, the website of Craig Unger, the author of House of Bush, House of Saud. As noted by Tom Flacco, the first flight corroborates earlier stories of a fifth Phantom flight from Tampa to Lexington on September 13th, when all regular flights were still grounded. By the way, parenthetically, we're going to take a look at some excerpts from the book House of Bush, House of Saud in the next side. That will be titled War Emblem. It's an excellent book, and I strongly recommend it for fleshing out understanding of these flights of influential Saudis, including members of the bin Laden family implicated in terrorism, out of the U.S. when no other civilians could fly. Check out House of Bush, House of Saud by Craig Unger. Continuing. All four flights carried members of the Saudi royal family. The first, from Lexington, Kentucky to London on September 15th, also carried a young man, Ahmad A.M. al-Hazmi, with the same family name as Nawaf al-Hazmi, one of the hijackers. There's nothing to connect the two al-Hazmis directly, but the hijacker Nawaf had already been connected in press stories to the Saudi royal family as the recipient of funds coming indirectly from the wife of Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States. And I would add, by the way, those funds appear to have moved through the Riggs Bank in Washington that handles the accounts for the Saudi embassy. One of the directors of the Riggs Bank is Jonathan Bush, George W.'s uncle, again exemplifying the structural economic relationships between the House of Bush and the House of Saud. Quoting here from an article from the Weekly Standard, and again we're quoting from Peter Dale Scott's website, scandal struck again in November of 2002 and touched Princess Haifa al-Faisal, wife of Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the longtime Saudi ambassador to Washington and nephew of Prince Nayef. It was learned that money had gone from her purse to the pockets of two 9/11 hijackers, Khalid al-Maidar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, by way of two Saudi intermediaries, Omar al-Bayoumi and Osama Basnan. And again, that's an article by Stephen Schwartz in the conservative Weekly Standard of August 12th of 2003. Continuing with Peter's posting, on the flight was the noted horse breeder Prince Ahmad bin Salman bin Abdulaziz, the owner of the Kentucky Derby winner War Emblem. After returning to Saudi Arabia, he died suddenly of a heart attack at the age of 43. His cousin, Prince Sultan bin Faisal bin Turki bin Abdullah, aged 41, was killed in a car accident the next day on his way to Prince Ahmed's funeral. With him was his nephew, Prince Sultan bin Fahad bin Salman Abdul Aziz. Prince Sultan's presence on the flight corroborates a story from the Tampa Tribune of October 5th, 2001, which talks of a Prince Sultan bin Fahad flying from Tampa on September 13th, when all regular flights to Lexington, quote, where the prince's relatives were buying, when all regular flights were grounded to Lexington, quote, where the prince's relatives were buying racehorses, unquote. We're going to deal with War Emblem inside two of this broadcast. Another interesting aspect of air travel on September 11th, and that concludes, that concerns, I should say, where the elder George Bush was. The elder George Bush was in Washington, D.C., at the annual investor conference of the Carlyle Group at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. The Carlyle Group, one of the ventures that joins the Bushes and the Bin Laden families. And then, according to report, and we're going to be reading now from the book The Iron Triangle by Dan Briody. This is published in hardcover by John Wiley & Sons, copyright 2003. The elder George Bush was flying out of Washington, D.C., as the American Airlines Flight 77 was getting ready to reverse course and fly into the Pentagon. That same morning, speaking of September 11th, in the plush setting of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, D.C., the Carlyle Group was holding its annual International Investor Conference. Frank Carlucci, James Baker III, David Rubenstein, William Conway, and Dan Doniello were together, along with a host of former world leaders, former defense experts, wealthy Arabs from the Middle East, and major international investors as the terror played out on television. There, with them, looking after the investments of his family, was Shafiq bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's estranged half-brother. George Bush Sr. was also at the conference, but Carlyle's spokesperson says the former president left before the terror attacks and was on an airplane over the Midwest when flights across the country were grounded on the morning of September 11th. So the elder George Bush was in Washington on September 11th and was winging his way out as the attacking planes were winging their way in. The elder George Bush has been in some interesting places in the air. We're going to replay a section now from For the Record 236 called Trouble on Oiled Waters, Part 4, recorded on July 16th of the year 2000. We're going to listen to where the elder George Bush was on another fateful day, November 22nd, 1963. And from the book we used before, W, The Revenge of the Bush Dynasty, by Elizabeth W. Mitchell, here's where George W. Bush was when Kennedy was killed. On November 22, 1963, Barbara Bush was at the beauty parlor getting her hair done in Tyler, Texas, and writing a letter home. Back in September, George Bush had become the first declared Republican candidate for the 1964 Senate elections, a Goldwater Republican, and the two of them were now on a several-city campaign swing. George came to pick her up, and they flew on a Mr. Zeppo's private plane, which he disembarked in Fort Worth, and then flew the Bushes back to Dallas.
They had to circle while they waited for the second presidential plane to take off. George W. H. W. Bush in interesting places at interesting times, as has been his son, George W. Bush.
That again from FDR 236 from July 16th of the year 2000. This concludes For the Record 459, Flying the Friendly Skies, being recorded on May 10th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.